Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 12, 2015, during a live Teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's Teleform conference call and a discussion of net neutrality, the FCC, the FTC, agency authority, and more. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome today Commissioner of the United States Federal Trade Commission, the Honorable Joshua D. Wright. He's going to give us some opening remarks on the various topics of about 15 or so minutes, but then we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please do be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the program. And in order to get right to the program, let me just turn things over to Commissioner Wright.
Thanks, Dean, and thanks for the invitation and to the Federal Society for having me. Let me start with my conventional disclaimer. Anytime I've got a microphone, even over a telephone line, that what you hear out of me for the next 15 minutes will be my own views and not necessarily the views of the Federal Trade Commission or any of its other commissioners. That said, and out of the way, I sort of will jump right into the topic of the day, and I'll talk about my views with respect to the FCC's newest so-called net neutrality regulation, and I'm going to focus on a few things. The first and foremost being why the FCC's Title II net neutrality proposal doesn't make sense from an economic perspective, but I'll sort of then turn to discussing the various implications of the Title II regulation for the Federal Trade Commission. And then, of course, we'll be happy to take whatever questions you might have. So, of course, when I refer to the FCC's newest net neutrality regulation, as many of you may be or are familiar with, I mean the FCC's decision to regulate broadband providers as common carriers under Title II of the Communications Act of 1934, and that decision will make consumers of broadband internet service worse off rather than better off. Central to my conclusion that the FCC's attempts to regulate so-called net neutrality in the broadband industry will ultimately do more harm than good for consumers is that the FCC and commentators have failed to identify in the first instance a problem worthy of regulation, much less cumbersome public utility style regulation under Title II. Nevertheless, to the extent any threat to consumer welfare accrues as a result of broadband providers contracting with content providers to provide preferential service, it's my belief that the antitrust laws and the federal agencies, including the FTC, and private entities empowered to enforce those laws are exceptionally well suited to handle any such problems as they arise. These first two points establish that the FCC's decision to regulate broadband providers under Title II is both unnecessary and also misguided. Unfortunately, the decision will also have the troubling consequence of stripping the FTC of its jurisdiction to enforce its broad consumer protection powers against broadband providers, depriving consumers of beneficial oversight. Before I turn to explaining why I believe antitrust enforcement superior to net neutrality in terms of promoting consumer welfare in the broadband industry, it's worthwhile first to discuss whether there are any economic bases at all for regulating broadband. What market failure, in other words, and as an economist might ask, if any, is the FCC trying to solve with net neutrality regulations? Chairman Wheeler wrote in a recent article that, quote, the fundamental problem is allowing networks to act as gatekeepers. Well, the word gatekeeper could certainly have some relevant economic meaning. It's important, then, to pin down exactly what we think the chairman means by the term. There are gatekeepers everywhere in the modern economy. Starbucks is the gatekeeper to my all-important morning cup of coffee, and the supermarket's the gatekeeper to your access to Cheerios or your breakfast cereal of choice in the supermarket aisle. A gatekeeper, importantly, becomes an economic problem potentially worthy of regulation only when the gatekeeper stands between consumers and the only source of a desirable good or service, that is, in the presence of monopoly power. If consumers are able to get coffee from sources other than Starbucks, And then Starbucks won't be able to manipulate consumers' access to coffee in a way that makes consumers worse off. Because if it does, of course, consumers are able to buy coffee from other sources. In short, it's competition that ensures that firms supply consumers access to the goods or services they want. In other words, the gatekeeper issue identified by Chairman Wheeler is a problem worthy of regulation only insofar as the broadband industry is a natural monopoly or otherwise exhibits meaningful monopoly power. That is, the power to artificially increase market prices and decrease market output. The simple fact that there are multiple suppliers of both wired and wireless broadband internet renders this justification of regulation fairly unpersuasive. The gatekeeper justification for broad sweeping net neutrality regulation can't possibly justify those regulations because no broadband provider can be viewed as a gatekeeper to anything when there is viable competition from other broadband providers. On the other hand, it could be that the desire, quote, to preserve the internet as an open platform for innovation and free expression, as Chairman Wheeler expressed, reflects concern about externalities rather than natural monopoly or monopoly power generally. Indeed, Chairman Wheeler has touted that the latest Title II net neutrality regulation will, quote, ban paid prioritization and the blocking and throttling of lawful content and services. Perhaps the concerns that broadband provider and content provider don't internalize all the costs associated with the contractual arrangement through which the content provider pays the broadband provider for priority use of a network. The argument seems to be there's some social interest in egalitarian access to all broadband providers' networks, in effect, a one-size-fits-all contract between broadband providers and content providers, and that we can't trust the marketplace to reach this outcome without regulatory intervention. An argument that the broadband market ought to be regulated because of externalities not captured in the bargains between broadband providers and content providers may be economically coherent, but insofar as I've seen the evidence, it lacks any basis in fact. At this point, the problems associated with giving certain content providers preferential access to the network, and by extension, providing certain content providers with degraded access, are purely theoretical. This concern about externalities requires considerations of the economics of the bargains between broadband providers and content providers. Broadband providers and content providers occupy different positions in the supply chain. The Netflix customer needs both content supplied through Netflix and broadband access supplied through one of any number of broadband providers in order to enjoy Netflix's video streaming product. An arrangement between Netflix and one broadband provider that ensures a certain level of speed for customers using the broadband provider's network to access Netflix is what economists call a vertical contractual arrangement because it's between two entities operating at two different links in the same supply chain. The world's full of these vertical contracts in all sorts of different industries. And industrial organization economists have been studying these types of vertical contractual arrangements for decades, so we know quite a bit about their marketplace effects generally. It's now well accepted in the economics profession that vertical contracts occasionally can lead to competitive harm under certain conditions. Proponents of net neutrality regulation traditionally have responded to this concern by favoring a rigid categorical ban or other significant restrictions upon broadband providers' ability to enter into vertical contracts. Indeed, the FCC's latest Title II regulation includes just such a ban. Fearing that any such network discrimination by broadband providers creates undue risk of competitive harm, Title II proponents argue for a categorical one-size-fits-all approach. The problem is that approach defies modern economic learning in at least two ways. First, and as I'll explain in greater detail, the FCC's Title II approach ignores the empirical economic research that demonstrates plainly that these sorts of vertical contractual arrangements very rarely result in consumer harm. Second, economists have long understood that the types of business arrangements at issue here often provide substantial benefits for consumers. To give a sampling, such arrangements can create cost-saving efficiencies that are passed on to consumers by reducing double marginalization, preventing free riding on manufacturer-supplied investments, and aligning the incentives of manufacturers and distributors. In fact, vertical contracts are frequently observed in real-world markets between firms lacking any meaningful market power at all, implying there must be some efficiency justifications, some pro-consumer explanations for these practices, rather than explanations that depend on a firm with market power using these contracts to exclude competitors. All of these efficiencies must at least be partially passed on to consumers in the form of lower prices, increased output, higher quality, or greater innovation. In other words, the monopoly explanation, the gatekeeper explanation, that a monopolist uses vertical contracts to foreclose rivals from access to a critical input or a critical set of customers, cannot be the reason for most instances of these types of vertical contracts in any of the markets studied or in broadband markets themselves. As I mentioned, there's considerable empirical evidence that strongly supports the view that vertical contracts are more often than not pro-competitive. I've summarized this body of literature in my own academic writing elsewhere, but as one study puts it, and I quote, "With few exceptions, the literature does not support the view that these practices are used for anti-competitive reasons, which supports, quote again, a fairly strong prior belief that these practices are unlikely to be anti-competitive in most cases." In my view, it's quite fair to say there's a general consensus among empirical economists on this point. It is, in my view, impossible to reconcile the FCC's Title II approach with a reasonable interpretation of the best available economic theory and empirical evidence. That analysis is wholly consistent with the FTC's own report on the broadband industry from 2007. That report, spearheaded by now FTC Commissioner Maureen Olhausen, explained that vertical restraints, again, I quote, generally need not be anti-competitive or otherwise pernicious and are often driven by efficiency considerations. That report concluded, again consistent with the economics literature over the past several decades, that although in theory vertical restraints could, I quote again, prompt internet access providers to block or degrade content or applications, the debate on net neutrality has not provided any good exposition of answers to the question of whether pro or anti-competitive outcomes are likely to occur as a result of any of these particular vertical restraints, contracts between broadband providers and content providers. Surely, given the state of the economics literature and the FTC's own report, the categorical prohibition as adopted by the FCC is inappropriate from an economic perspective. Finally, to the extent the order does not prohibit certain business arrangements outright, it creates substantial uncertainty through its broad general conduct rule, which allows the FCC substantial discretion to decide whether new practices harm consumers or edge providers. The uncertainty associated with the general conduct rule itself is also likely to deter firms from engaging in all sorts of pro-consumer economic activity. Let me turn to the advantages of antitrust over a categorical ex-ante prohibition on vertical contracts. If there were strong evidence that the types of vertical contracts the FCC is seeking to ban harm consumers, a categorical ban could make some sense. But as I've explained, the best available evidence points in precisely the opposite direction. However, it's undeniably true that vertical contracts can result in anti-competitive outcomes in some circumstances. This raises a fairly interesting regulatory question for the FCC. If an outright ban on vertical restraints can't be justified, yet there's some chance that vertical restraints could harm broadband consumers, what should the FCC do? The answer here, I think, is nothing. And the reason is that the FTC, my agency, is exceptionally well equipped to pick up the slack. With the efforts of the antitrust agencies not enough, the antitrust laws also provide for private rights of action and remedies, including treble damages, more than sufficient to put to rest concerns about inadequate enforcement. Indeed, President Obama's current regulatory czar and former director of the FTC's own Bureau of Economics, Howard Schlansky, has noted antitrust enforcement is often superior to broad regulation. The problem with the FCC's approach to net neutrality is that there's no way to identify the vertical contracts that are likely to be problematic ex ante. If the empirical economic evidence is correct or even reasonably accurate, then most contracts of this type will benefit consumers, and there will also be some that generate a real risk of competitive harm. In other words, the FCC is faced with a lack of any reliable and economically sound method to identify prospectively network discrimination that should be barred as anti-competitive or absolved as pro-competitive. But what is a novel policy dilemma for the FCC is a problem that antitrust has been grappling with for over a century and for which it offers a clear solution. Over the course of the last century, antitrust jurisprudence has evolved a highly sophisticated rule of reason analysis to adjudicate various types of vertical arrangements by analyzing their cost and benefits to consumers. The rule of reason requires each vertical arrangement be scrutinized on a case-by-case basis by marshaling the available economic literature and empirical evidence to evaluate the evidence of actual competitive impact under the specific circumstances of the case. Indeed, and importantly, antitrust law initially adopted but ultimately rejected, largely based upon the development of the economic and empirical literature I've already discussed, a categorical prohibition of certain vertical restraints, not unlike the FCC's Title II prohibition on paid prioritization. The reason antitrust courts and agencies rejected the view underlying the president and the FCC's ban is that a revolution injecting that economic analysis and method into antitrust law swept through its institutions in the 60s and 70s. The FCC need not catch up its understanding of industrial organization economics to the state of the art in 2015 to get this regulatory solution right. It only needs to embrace what was well understood by 1977 when the Supreme Court first accepted the basic economic principles that rejected categorical prohibitions of vertical contracts, the very type embraced by net neutrality proponents of today. My view is that antitrust rule of reason is far more likely to maximize consumer welfare in the broadband industry than the FCC's outright ban. As a general matter, any legal framework that seeks to maximize consumer welfare must take at least three factors into account. First, the framework must assess the underlying probability that the challenged business arrangement is anti-competitive. Second, the framework must assess the probability that its application will result in errors, whether they be false positives in which arrangements that benefit consumers are prohibited, or false negatives in which arrangements that harm consumers are allowed. Third, any regulatory framework must acknowledge the administrative cost of implementing the system. A rule that focuses upon minimizing the social cost, the cost to consumers, of false positives, false negatives, and administrative costs is most likely to generate the highest rate of return for consumers. Analyzing the FCC's Title II prohibition under this framework is fairly easy. There'll be no false negatives, only false positives. Instances of pro-competitive conduct will no doubt be erroneously condemned, unless one thinks that the entirety of the empirical research on the effects of vertical restraints is wrong. It's true that the rule of reason is probably more costly to administer in the individual case than the FCC's blanket prohibition, but the administrative cost the FCC incurs in developing, defining, defending, and redefining whatever net neutrality order ultimately gets upheld by a court, and it has not been successful in this endeavor for a decade, is not trivial either. Although the affirmative case for antitrust over net neutrality is clear on consumer welfare grounds, net neutrality proponents often assert that because antitrust might not work in all cases, that is, the rule of reason might allow some vertical contracts that do in fact harm consumers, a blanket prohibition against all priority contracts is superior. In my view, this argument rejects a consumer welfare-based approach to regulation altogether by assuming, contrary to all available theory, evidence, and experience, that each and every instance of conduct prohibited by the FCC's plan will be harmful. The argument also seems to suggest that there is some category of harm to consumers that falls outside of the dimensions cognizable within antitrust law and consumer protection, which include price, output, quality, and innovation. But that dimension is both ubiquitous enough to justify categorical prohibition, but also, strangely, only observable to the FCC. That should be enough to make any student of regulatory law or economics nervous. I'm quite confident the antitrust regime, after more than a century of developing expertise and applying the rule of reason and using economic tools to do so, will be able to apply it to the broadband industry. Let me conclude my remarks by turning to the FTC's other enforcement priority, consumer protection. By reclassifying broadband internet providers as common carriers under Title II, the FCC threatens to strip the FTC of its jurisdiction to regulate broadband providers as part of its consumer protection mission. The FTC has been active in this space for at least the last 20 years, and the FCC's regulation, Title II, would displace much pro-consumer activity by the FTC. I believe reclassification under Title II, for this reason alone, will unequivocally harm consumers by depriving them of the FTC's activities in the broadband sector. The FTC has done some remarkable consumer The FTC has done some remarkable consumer protection work in this sector, and since the advent of the internet, the FTC has been the primary federal enforcement agency identifying problematic practices related to deceptive advertising, privacy, and data security, as well as enforcement actions designed to stop these practices and to deter others from adopting similar practices that harm consumers. Before reclassifying broadband services under Title II, and thereby outside the reach of the FTC, it is important to consider the ramifications of depriving broadband consumers of the FTC's specialized enforcement abilities and its accompanying decades of expertise. At least one cognizable and immediately accrued cost to consumers of the reclassification to Title II has been to eliminate the FTC's consumer protection activities. I'll stop there. Thank you for your time, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Commissioner Wright. Let's open the floor to questions from the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We'll get to those calls in just a second. First, a quick announcement that tomorrow at noon, we'll be hosting a special CLE Teleforum conference call at which members can get up to 1 hour of CLE ethics credit. There's a payment required, and you can go to our website to get more details, but that is tomorrow at noon. Then Thursday at 3 p.m., we'll be talking about GMO food litigation, and Friday at 1 p.m., we'll be talking about the level of First Amendment protection for non-media speech. Today, of course, we're talking to FTC Commissioner Joshua Wright. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one caller with a question, so our lines will be open after this first question, but now let's go to our first caller.
Thank you. This is John Gorin in Dallas. I don't use Netflix, and the question I have, and whether it has been considered, is the average consumer doesn't need a lot of broadband space. Why should I subsidize those who do?
So I take it in part, aside from the use of Netflix, and maybe we can talk about some other examples of things that would be banned under the Title II rule that maybe hit closer to home. So, you know, Netflix is the example I like to use because it's popular, but tell you the truth, I don't watch it either. So let me use some other examples of vertical contracts that would be banned. So for example, if a network would like to contract, a broadband provider would like to contract with a content provider. I don't do Netflix, but I do ESPN, and I would like to watch sort of as much live sports content on my phone as I can. Now, of course, this takes up a lot of data. In ESPN of the world, and this is just to use a generic example, can, and many do, and have explored arrangements such as this, will contract with a network provider to subsidize my use of their live stream. So, you know, normally this counts against my data cap and can run up my bill. And ESPN wants to go to, say, Verizon and say, for any of the data that Josh uses while he is watching our content, we'll pay for that. We don't want that to count against his bill. Those sorts of contracts between network providers and content providers and competition among them to provide these sorts of agreements are banned under Title II. Now, some of those agreements might benefit you and some you may not care so much about. But what the FCC rule has done is said any of those vertical contracts that reach any consumer, you know, whether it's the sports consumer, or I can, you know, we can have other sorts of content that you may want to use that benefit the consumer in terms of lowering the price per unit of data that he uses are strictly banned in the name of preventing the fear of vertical contracts that will exclude somebody. On net, the economic evidence is pretty clear that these vertical sorts of arrangements do more good than harm. And so, you know, in terms of whether the net effect on consumers altogether, you know, the economics are fairly clear. It's a bad deal for consumers. You know, I don't want to get sort of too pinned down on any of the sort of set of examples. I mean, I know Netflix has dominated some of the net neutrality discussion, but this rule goes well beyond Netflix and really gets at any contractual business relationship between a content provider and a broadband provider. And that, I think, in light of the economic evidence, is what is a risky proposition for consumers, especially relative to the antitrust regime.
It seems to me, I don't understand the economics of the infrastructure of the internet, but in order to provide that kind of broadband experience, costs a lot of money. Somebody has to be paying for it. And if you have a completely level playing field, those who are using more data, more broadband, aren't paying for it. Everybody else is subsidizing it. I don't see that as good for consumers in general, because if those who are paying want that extra service are paying for it, then the money is there in the system, whether it's coming from distributors or however it plays out, to pay the cost of that investment. And in the long run, that benefits everybody.
So we're not disagreeing up until your last couple of sentences there.
Okay.
Right? So what the rule does, part of what you're talking about is deciding who pays for access over the infrastructure created by the network, right? And if I don't use a lot and you do, right, you might be subsidizing me or I might be subsidizing you depending on how we're charged for use, right? Now, part of what you're talking about is the fundamental question. The network has a scarce resource that it has invested in, that is the network itself, right? Now,
exactly.
let me turn sort of the argument around on you a little bit. What the FCC rule does is said, I mean, normally the way, the sort of basic economic concept we think about when we've got a scarce resource and we want to ration it to its highest valued use, we have prices. The price system does that. What the FCC rule does is say, you cannot have that sort of allocation. So if there's a content provider that's taking all sorts of my network space, and there's one that's taking very little, the way that we normally think about dealing in economics with the scarce resources, the network provider says, well, listen, we're going to increase the price if you're going to take all of this bandwidth from me. And what the FCC rule does is says you cannot use prices to allocate resources.
Right. That's my problem.
That's my problem, too. So that's the part maybe we're agreeing with each other all the way through, sir.
And I liken it to the movement to have higher tolls on roadways, for example, for the speedy lanes or during high traffic times. It's a complete reversal of how our economic system allocates scarce resources.
Well, now we're agreeing on all the things, right? So that's exactly right. And one of the arguments that's commonly made, and I think the road example is a nice way to think about this. One of the examples that's commonly made by sort of Title II proponents is, if I speed up your traffic, then someone else's has to be degraded. And if you think about the road example, I think this is sort of you can get a better economic intuition. If we've got an express lane and people are willing, you know, we're going to ration some of that resource by the price system, then the people who want to pay the most for speed use it. And that decreases congestion on the rest of the highway. That is, It is good for both when we ration by price. I think the important thing, and one of the odd things about the way that this net neutrality debate has proceeded over the past decade or so, it has really been a battle over sort of anecdotes and marginal cases. I mean, if one searches through the FCC's order justifying the Title II regulation, and indeed its prior order, there's a compilation of a handful of anecdotes about a network provider doing something to get a content provider off of its network or degrade service. Now, they all have reasons for why they think they did this, but we're talking about, you know, a handful of anecdotes. And the regulatory response has been to ban all of these agreements, including agreements that just sort of plainly benefit consumers. One of the examples I like to give that actually was gave rise to the first net neutrality complaint was, and this was, you know, even before we had Title II, was an arrangement between Metro PCS. So Metro PCS was trying to sort of enter and make a competitive impact in the sort of maybe lower quartile, lower half of the, you know, price space in terms of competition between providers. They were sort of taking the lower end and lower and middle income consumers, and they had a, you know, a 4G LTE network, and they were competing by offering phones that were, you know, a $50 all you can eat rate for access to their 4G LTE network. That was a much lower rate than anybody else had. And part of the reason they were able to do that was that they had made a special agreement with Google. You know, most of the data traveling over these phones is, you know, YouTube videos is a big chunk of it. And so they had a special compression algorithm technology that they had developed, or Google had developed with them, that allowed them to give consumers for this $50 flat rate, a rate that was, you know, very, very popular. He said, well, you can have sort of full all-you-can-eat access to Google and YouTube, but there wasn't unlimited access to all of the other applications. And so because they were able to offer sort of this, you know, innovative business model at low prices that was very popular with consumers, because there was not all-you-can-eat for every single application, it is, you know, in my view, would have been banned under the old rule and certainly banned under Title II. That is, I think, you know, the key, I think, the core of the debate here has been, you know, the supremacy of a handful of extreme anecdotes that have happened over the last, you know, 10 years over economic knowledge about sort of the average effect of these deals, which is we're talking about letting the price system allocate scarce resources, and we generally think of that as not only the efficient way to do things, but the pro-consumer way to do things. And the FCC rule, I think, on its own flips that on its head. But on top of that, rather than a categorical ban, the antitrust laws act in the background, right? And the antitrust laws say, when a firm abuses market power and harms consumers in the very way that the Title II proponents are worried about, that violates the antitrust laws. And, you know, because you've got – now, it requires proof. It requires proof. A plaintiff needs to come into court and show that the network has real monopoly power, that it abused its monopoly power, that it created harm to consumers. That can be hard to do in court, but – the difficulty of doing so, I think, is, you know, by my lights, a feature and not a bug of the antitrust laws, the fact that one must actually prove that consumers are harmed before they ban a voluntary business practice. And that, I think, is really, you know, highlights the superiority of the antitrust option.
Perhaps another way of looking at it is that the rule flies in the face of what we've seen in computers and telecommunications of early adopters. Early adopters are willing to pay more for that extra service and bandwidth, and the rule seems to completely ignore how our technological systems have advanced in the last 20 years.
I think that's certainly the case. There are, attracting earlier adopters is, but one economic reason that one might want to have one of these sort of special vertical combinations. This is really, we're talking about, when we talk about vertical contracts, I mean, this is the technical term economists like to use. We're really talking about economic cooperation between network providers and broadband providers. That can be to provide a new service, that can be to improve technology, that can be to lower price, that can be to attract consumers of any type, including early adopters for new technology. And it really is, any sort of deviation from, sort of a standard plain vanilla contract, standardized one-size-fits-all contract between a network provider and a broadband provider is going to violate Title II. It is sort of the flat-out economic reality that using prices to allocate what is well understood to be the scarce resource in this space is going to violate a regulatory rule. It's hard to make less economic sense than that.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Our lines are wide open now. If you have a question for Commissioner Wright, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see if somebody else rings in here. Let me ask you, you mentioned the process that was used to get here. I'm no expert by any means, but I understand it's been a long road, a lot of people advocating for net neutrality, a lot of people hesitant about it. My recollection was that FCC Commissioner, Chairman Wheeler, was originally against net neutrality, or perhaps against it in its current form, and somehow came around to change his mind. I'm wondering if you can describe that process a little bit more to the extent you have any insights into it. And I'm also wondering if you can address the notion that, technology is outstripping the original mandates of some regulatory agencies in a way that leaves them maybe casting about for something to regulate or ways to shoehorn their 10, 20, 30, 40-year-old enabling legislation into a technological situation that exists now that wasn't contemplated when that legislation was originally passed.
Sure. Let me start with the first one. I mean, I don't they're down the street from me, but I have no special insight as to what goes on process-wise inside the FCC. I read the court decisions like everyone else, and they've had a difficult time in the D.C. Circuit, and the decisions make that clear. It is certainly the case that there is there was an originally proposed net neutrality rule that articulated a case-by-case approach that is not identical and maybe not even sort of very similar to the antitrust case-by-case approach, but at least was a sort of ex post case-by-case adjudication that began with the premise that some vertical contracts would violate the rule and some would not. That was the original proposal. I think later in the game, with sort of plenty of intervening events, in popular in the popular sphere, the Stephen Colbert Show covering net neutrality and getting something like 4 million comments and some combination of for, against, and uninformed. Sort of on the record, and also the president coming out and saying he favored Title II. And later, the FCC sort of changed its tune and came out in favor of Title II. Now, much has been made about whether those intervening events caused a change or not. Sort of not being inside that agency myself, I don't have any special knowledge of that, but the sort of change, I think, speaks for itself, and now we've got Title II, and I think it's now sort of fair game to analyze the effects of Title II. I think the move to Title II from a consumer welfare perspective, from an economic perspective, is clearly worse. It is all of the things that are bad about rigid ex-ante regulation. And I think, you know, you contrast that approach to the antitrust approach. I mean, we had a per se categorical ban of vertical contracts in all industries in antitrust in the 1960s. It did not take long for the economics profession to figure out that that was a economically incoherent approach. And it didn't take long either for the Supreme Court to figure that out. By 1977, they had changed their tune on vertical restraints altogether and adopted a much more sophisticated economic approach. I think that gap, that contrast between antitrust and regulation on this sphere leaves certainly me, but I think most industrial organization economists, I think it's very difficult for an industrial organization economist, even one sort of with far more interventionist leanings than I, to try to make any sense of a categorical ban. It was a view that was rejected in antitrust 50 years ago, and over which there's been sort of unanimous agreement that that change was good. In terms, Dean, of the second question about technology outstripping the original mandate of an agency's authority, this is not to hit all nails with the same hammer, but this again I think is a story about a comparison between antitrust and regulation. So now, of course, there are many who have leveled the criticism of the FCC, and I think sort of rightly in many ways, that application of the 1934 Telecom Act to reclassify broadband as a telephone style public utility is sort of outdated and wrong. And there's obviously, I think, given my remarks, a lot of truth to that complaint. Now, proponents of Title II are quick to point out, well, the antitrust laws were passed in 1890, and that is even earlier. It's a little bit of a red herring. It is not the year in which the statute is enacted. If any student of telecom law versus antitrust law will tell you, the antitrust laws were designed to be, they were bare-bone statutes. Thou shalt not do engage in restraints of trade. And they were intentionally designed for courts to, through a common law style process, to put meat on the bones of the antitrust laws over time. They were built to evolve over time. I think it's one of the reasons I have as many qualms about modern application of antitrust law as anyone else you might find, but it is certainly the case that when compared to telecommunications law, and particularly the 1934 Act, it is certainly the case that the antitrust laws have performed much better. They've evolved much more quickly. They've adapted much more quickly to changes in economics and changes in economic thinking. Still with a lag, but much more quickly than the Telecommunications Act, despite the fact that they were passed in 1890. The question is one of design of the legal institution. The antitrust laws were meant to evolve. They were designed to evolve, and they've evolved. And it's taken some time and quite a bit of time, sometimes too long for them to get some answers right, and they still don't have them all right by any means. But the Telecom Act was designed to be a stiff, rigid, inflexible regulatory regime. That is what regulation is. It is antithetical to that type of flexibility. And so I think that the critique is not one about age, it's one about inflexibility. And I think part of the growing pains that one is seeing with the move from the case-by-case approach to Title II is sort of brings that inflexibility to the forefront. It highlights it. The FCC is bending over backwards to promise it is going to forbear from application of this section of the act or that section of the act. You know, they'll tell us which ones later and we'll do some rulemakings and so forth and so on. But the act simply does not give, and reclassification simply does not give the FCC the option to embrace a policy or the policy that would be best for consumers. Title II does not give the option to the FCC to say, look, these vertical contracts are good and we are going to allow them. These are not and we are going to ban them, and we're going to adopt an economically coherent way of distinguishing between the two. I think from where I sit, which is, you know, obviously not inside the FCC building, but from where I sit as an observer, I think that the process there has been quite clear that there is sort of an attempt to reclaim relevance of old-style public utility regulation for the Internet. And, you know, the regulatory order that comes out of that building is going to fit that conclusion, whatever the evidence says. And I think that, again, is you know, it is less about, you know, the vintage of the statute than the degree to which inflexibility is built into its DNA. In the case of the Telecom Act, I think that the extent there is severe. And I think that is the reason the diagnosis is as bad as it is and why the expected outcome should be at least as bad.
Once again, Commissioner Wright's on the phone with us. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Some people might argue, Commissioner Wright, that this, I mean, something this sweeping or this novel should have required legislation and amendments to the Telecommunications Act. Had there been any legislative attempts at net neutrality in the past?
Sure. There have been a couple of attempts, and there was a proposed bill on the table at the time that the FCC voted 3-2 on their current proposal. Senator Thune had put forward a bill that adopted a case-by-case approach that had some similarities with, frankly, with Chairman Wheeler and the FCC's original net neutrality approach. Some differences as well, but of course the key was that it was case-by-case rather than sort of prescriptive categorical prohibition. That approach was on the table and being discussed in the Senate at the time the FCC voted. I think there was substantial debate over whether the FCC should go ahead and vote or whether they should wait for a legislative solution. I think the course that they chose is clear. You know, the ramifications, I think, remain to be seen. I think the choice to do this by, I mean, one of the ramifications of that choice is something that we felt sort of here in my agency at the FTC, and that is the Thune net neutrality bill would have preserved the FTC's consumer protection authority. The minute that the FCC reclassified, the FTC, who, you know, does not have authority over common carriers, was, you know, its jurisdictional lunch money was taken with respect to application of its consumer protection authority, which we've used in deception cases in the broadband space fairly well. And the Thune bill, I think, would have resolved that without sort of immediately depriving consumers of our sort of basic consumer protection authority, whereas it is quite an odd situation, certainly not unprecedented, but quite an odd situation when one independent agency, by an agency action and not an act of Congress, is able to change the jurisdiction of another independent agency. And that is, I think, again, not unprecedented in the history of our nation, certainly, but a relatively rare occurrence. And unfortunately, one that I do not think there was much thought about. I don't think that in the FCC discussion, there was ever much thought about the Consumer Protection Authority implications at the FTC, or a sort of rigorous comparison between the Title II approach and antitrust laws that would be enforced by the FTC or DOJ. But it is, I think, skipping over or choosing to reject the congressional solution in favor of an agency action did result in that sort of odd occurrence of one independent agency through its own 3-2 vote shrinking substantially and in an important way the jurisdiction of another agency.
Can you say anything about whether and how the FTC was consulted by the FCC as it engaged in this process? That's part one of my next question. And then part two of the question is, I recall reading that sort of on the eve of the adoption of the net neutrality rules, there was a lot of, I don't know if you call it buyer's remorse or second thoughts by some of the proponents in the regulated community, some of the proponents of net neutrality, just as it was about to be adopted, sort of, I don't know if there were recalculations made, but there was some changes in the minds there. I don't know how else to categorize it, but respond to that if you could.
Sure. Now, with respect to consultation, I mean, I will tread a little bit carefully, but I will say, you know, to whatever extent there was consultation, I don't think it was enough. And, you know, for my own personal view, I would have liked to see my agency assert itself in the debate a little more aggressively. But in terms of we do cooperate with the FCC on some consumer protection investigations, I suspect that will continue. But I do think that in terms of, I mean, there is consumer protection expertise in this building, especially as it relates to privacy and data security, and also deceptive advertising that just sort of is unique to this agency, and I think it's developed a much more sort of nuanced approach to regulation in that space. Then takes place at the FCC. And so I think that move is, you know, the problem is not just sort of sacrificing jurisdiction or shifting jurisdiction from one agency to another. The problem is that the approach that's been developed at the FTC over time, over a substantial amount of time, is one that I think is case by case an approach, is more economically sophisticated, and I think overall better for consumers than the approach likely adopted to these issues, and some of them quite new issues for the FCC. So, you know, there was certainly awareness of what was going to happen to FTC jurisdiction at the time, but I'm not sure how much weight it was given by the FCC or Congress for that matter.
Sure.
With respect to the second question, which, remind me, Dean, was
about the buyer's remorse. Of
right.
I don't know if I've even got that right. So the first part of that question is, do I recall this correctly, that
there's been all sorts of remorse all the way around with respect to Title II. I think some of it buyers and, you know, some of it sellers. In terms of the buyer's remorse, there were reports from a number of companies that had said they wanted some form of net neutrality, saying, wait a minute, we didn't mean Title II. And companies of a variety of companies switching positions from for to against, for the case by case, but probably not Title II. There's been a lot of sort of flipping around. I think part of that is to do with what really were process issues, and you know, I'm not an expert on FCC process, so I don't have anything to say about whether this process is regular or irregular for their normal course of business, but people weren't able to see the order. And it's difficult to know how much for or against you are some specific regulatory regime until you have had time to read the regulatory regime. I've read it, you know, from front to back, and, you know, this is not something that can be done in a short amount of time. So I think it took, you know, time to absorb once it was published, but it wasn't published for the public to consume until after it was voted out. So I think that, you know, compared to the FTC process, that is a strange animal to me when one compares it to FTC process, but, you know, may or may not be normal fare for the FCC. I know there were commissioners there, Commissioner Pai in particular, who had pointed out some of the abnormalities in the process, but I don't have any specific expertise with respect to that. I will say, you know, if you've got a very lengthy and detailed regulatory regime, and Title II is that, and a complicated one, and you can't see it until after the agency has voted it, it is no surprise that people, it sort of takes some time for people to figure out where they are after they absorb it, and apparently, reading what was actually in the document got some firms that were for it to change their mind.
Interesting stuff. It looks like we're just about out of time, Commissioner, but let me give you a minute or two to express any final thought you might have.
I think I've gotten it all out there. You know, I think I will leave more with a question than any, or at least some food for thought rather than any sort of closing analytical observation, and that is, it is obviously likely that this Title II challenge is going to be decided, you know, at least in the first instance by the D.C. Circuit, and maybe ultimately by the Supreme Court, and, you know, a lot of different things are possible, and, you know, the FCC commissioners have, you know, made no secret of their dissenting commissioners have made no secret of their views that they suspect that the order, the Title II order, will be rejected by the D.C. Circuit, at least significant parts of it. It's a big order. It would not be surprising if some survived scrutiny and others did not. I think now that will take some time, and in the meantime, the interim effects at the FTC sort of, you know, continue. But I think the thing to think about for those following this debate is my own view is the smart money suggests that at least part, and probably a substantial part, given the track record, a substantial part of this order gets overturned. And the question about how, whether, and who should regulate broadband is going to be up for grabs when that happens. And so my own experience with the way that the net neutrality debate took place the first, well, this time around, I guess this time wasn't the first, but this time around, was that there was not much discussion on sort of the first principles. what's the basis for regulation? What's the economic basis that we have that either supports or does not support that form of regulation? I think very quickly the debate turned political and into a 3-2 decision with lots of political fighting and infighting and action between an independent agency and the president's office and so forth. I suspect, you know, the substantive level of that debate I found rather disappointing. Not much thought about economic impact, not real serious discussion about those issues. The part about the D.C. Circuit throwing out the rules, if that is indeed what happens, that I think I am looking forward to is a chance to have the debate on proper terms. I suspect that the debate is going to come back full circle and we get a chance to do it again and talk about issues like whether we should regulate, who should regulate, the respective role of antitrust versus ex-ante regulation. These were important substantive economic debates that we've had in broadband and in other markets in this country for quite some time, and for some reason I think we only delved into superficially when it came to net neutrality, and I'm hoping that we can do better next time. So I will close on that.
Well, thank you very much, Commissioner Wright. Sounds like more to come is the final message there. And hopefully you're amenable to joining us once again at some point in the future when there's a development of moment. But for today, thank you so much for joining us. We certainly appreciate it. To our audience, thank you as well for joining us. A reminder that we're having our special CLE Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Time. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.